Coming up on December 7th, you are going to find four constitutional amendments on your ballot. Every time we need to break down constitutional amendments, we turn to the Public Affairs Research Council. And today we have their research director, Melinda DeLatt, on with us. Melinda, good morning. Welcome back to Talk 107.3. How are you?
I'm good, Brian. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I got to tell you, the constitutional amendment that was on the November ballot was so cut and dry, so easy.
Not these.
No!
No, this is, I am pretty confident that during their holiday shopping season, people are not thinking about four constitutional amendments that are pretty arcane issues that don't rise to the level of things people are thinking about on a day-to-day basis.
100%. And I don't know if that's, well, I don't, that doesn't feel healthy to me. I know you're not going to get into the ups and downs and the opinions of it. You're just here to break down the analysis of it. So let's dive in. Amendment number one, per the PAR constitutional amendments breakdown, do you support an amendment to allow the Supreme Court to sanction a judge upon an investigation by the Judiciary Commission and provide that the recommended sanction shall be instituted by the Judiciary Commission or by a majority of the Supreme Court and to provide for the appointment of five members of the Judiciary Commission? What does that mean?
Is a voter still awake at this point is the, probably the first question. So, look, the Judiciary Commission is a really important commission. It essentially deals with allegations of misconduct against judges in the state. So the way it works now is it's largely independent from the Supreme Court. It's got nine appointees that are three judges, three lawyers, and three people who are just regular citizens, not judges or lawyers. This amendment would add five new members, all political appointees from the House, Senate, and the governor. And it would also give the Supreme Court the authority to direct the commission to investigate some of the judicial misconduct allegations. Because right now, the way the commission works, it makes recommendations to the Supreme Court for sanctions against judges or for removal of judges, but the Supreme Court cannot actually make recommendations to the commission to investigate certain judges. So this would give them that authority, and it would expand the membership to five more people.
Okay, so in the world of checks and balances, if you're one that believes that there aren't enough checks and balances on the judicial side, this gives a little bit more power back to the executive and legislative branches.
Essentially, and one of the arguments has been that the Judiciary Commission moves sort of too slowly in terms of moving through its allegations and investigating things. So, and that they, perhaps aren't transparent enough. So the senator who proposed this thought this was a way to, in his mind, add some transparency and, adding more people could somehow force them to move more quickly. Now, I'll say what opponents said is what would allow them to move more quickly is hiring more staff to actually do the investigations because the commission has a fairly small staff. They argue, of course, that adding appointees of the House, Senate, and the governor just makes it more of a political mess, essentially, than, a well-thought-through process. So those are kind of the supporting and opposing arguments for it.
Without bringing up any names locally here, but how do we define misconduct? Is this a matter of can you have legislators and or the governor who believe that sentences or bonds are too lenient along the way and want to bring that into question?
Well, the Constitution outlines sort of the list of improper behavior, and it's things like willful misconduct relating to a judge's official duties, persistent failure to perform a judge's duties, public conduct that's prejudicial to the administration of justice, and then conduct in office that's, a felony or could be a felony. So it's a very specific set of things that are listed. But, of course, the argument from opponents is that, there's some gray area in there. And if you have political appointees, is that give them a window of some kind to go after judges who otherwise have been complying with the law. Of course, the argument on the other side is that the Supreme Court often gets blamed for not dealing with judicial misconduct or what people perceive as judicial misconduct. And this would give them the authority to actually direct some investigations since they publicly get blamed for it, but they don't necessarily have authority over the investigations right now.
We're talking with Melinda DeLatte from the Public Affairs Research Council about the four constitutional amendments that are on the December ballot. Okay, let's move from Amendment 1 to Amendment 2. This is about, well, it's about a 48-hour wait period before getting concurrence from a conference committee. Talk to me a little bit about what this one does, because I do have some hesitation on this one.
So this one stems from essentially the 2023 legislative session. I'm sure most people have moved on in their thoughts from that year, but what happened at the end of that regular session, it was sort of chaos. In the last 30 minutes of session, both the House and the Senate were asked to pass a package of more than $50 billion in budget bills after some deals were worked out behind the scenes. And the legislative session was about to end, so they had a half an hour to pass all these bills. And a lot of legislators felt like they didn't have enough participation in the process, or they didn't know what they were voting on in some instances. So what this amendment would do is it would require legislators to wait at least 48 hours when they get proposed amendments to bills appropriating money. When they get to that final vote for final passage to send it to the governor, they'd have to have 48 hours to review these bills and the amendments to them before they actually take a vote. Now, I will say that the House and Senate have rules that require this 48-hour waiting period. They can just regularly suspend them, and they often do.
Right.
So this would mandate it in the Constitution and give them no way to suspend.
Okay. Does this also mandate that everything be turned in 2 days before, 48 hours prior to sine die?
Essentially, I mean, if they can't make the 48-hour deadline, then they can't comply with this. So then, you know, they would have to turn it in 48 hours ahead of time, or they would not be able to pass a budget bill in the time period allotted. So this would sort of try to force the legislative leadership's hand to strike deals earlier and give, like, sort of the rank and file legislators more time to read through the bills. Now, of course, the supporting argument for that is that obviously it makes sense when you're spending billions of dollars of taxpayer money that legislators should have time to know what they're voting on. They should be able to think through if they support these decisions and if they support the proposals. And the opposing argument is, you know, essentially, They are grown-ups. They should be able to finish their business and not put these sort of artificial deadlines on themselves. They've elected their legislative leaders, who are the ones who are negotiating these final deals, so there should be processes in place for them to find out what's in the bills. And they already have, you know, these as House and Senate rules that they could just follow their own rules, and that this is language that shouldn't really be in a constitution per se, and that it is best left to statute or to House and Senate procedural rules.
And of course, all that changes if Amendment 3 passes.
Right. So Amendment 3 is like pretty much a companion to Amendment 2, but I do want to stress that they're not actually linked. So one could pass without the other passing. But what Amendment 3 does is it would give the legislature, with a two-thirds vote, the ability to extend the legislative session past its deadline for up to 6 days in 2-day increments, only to pass bills that appropriate money. So essentially these budget bills. So if they can't pass it in the timeline that they have, or they want more time to read through the bills, this would give the legislature the ability, with a two-thirds vote, to vote to extend it for 48 hours and then do another extension for 48 hours if they need it. What happens now is if they don't finish the budget bills at sine die, at the deadline for the regular session, they are forced to call a special session, and then they have to start the whole process over from scratch, where they introduce new bills and go through a whole committee process and debate on the floor and all the things all over again from scratch. This gives them the ability to avoid that. So supporters say, you know, obviously this is a good idea to allow them to have more time. The Constitution is the appropriate place to put this language. And quite frankly, you need to, the Constitution has the requirements for how long sessions can run. So it has to be in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Opponents argue that these bills are sort of the most important bills that the legislature passes in any given session. So they should just prioritize them in the time they know they have. and focus on these bills and, you know, use the time allotted to them to pass these without causing more taxpayer dollars to be spent to extend the session.
Well, yes. So if you have a problem with the way they prioritize bills right now, this would be a hard no. Although, Melinda, I can't help but think that we live in a state where we're going to vote yes on two and no on three. It just it feels like the most backward thing we can get out of it.
I mean, I can see scenarios where, and look, the sponsor of these said, you know, they were philosophically tied, though they're not legally tied.
Right.
So, yes, I can see a scenario where people are more sympathetic to the argument of requiring them to spend more time on these budget bills, but not necessarily sympathetic to the argument of spending more money to extend a session.
Right.
And that's the risk you run with these is like what happens if one passes and not the other. But, you know, arguably, if they know they have a 48-hour waiting period, even if they don't have extra time, they will have to work through the calendar.
No, absolutely. And it would require a little bit of discipline on their part, to be sure. So, two and three felt very straightforward to me. One and four were the ones where I had the most questions. So could you please explain Amendment 4 to me?
I'm going to try to do my best here.
Okay.
And I'm going to tell you that this is really – Amendment 4 is complex, is difficult to explain. And folks at PAR have said that this is the most complicated thing they've ever seen. People who've been there longer than I have said this is more complicated than almost any amendment they've ever had to write about or see. So that's my warning. That's not a judgment of whether the amendment is good or bad. It's just logistically, this is very difficult to explain.
Yes.
And it's in the Constitution, so they have to change the Constitution to change this system. So I think, you know, apologies to voters for having to navigate this one because this one's difficult. So this is essentially about when someone doesn't pay their property taxes. So local governments obviously get property taxes from homeowners and businesses to run their services. Currently, when somebody doesn't pay property taxes, local government can put the property up for sale in what's called technically called a tax sale process, but what's known to probably to most people as a sheriff's sale. But the way it works now is there's a 3-year waiting period where the original owner can seek to reclaim the property by paying off the debt and some penalties. And there are all these other pieces and parts that I will not get into. The bottom line is what this would change us to is something called a tax lien auction process. So it would be a different way of handling somebody not paying for their property taxes on time. Essentially, instead of buying the property, an investor or whoever it is who is interested in this property would buy the debt. Essentially, like the way a mortgage works, a person would own the lien and can force a foreclosure process to sell off the property to pay off the lien. There's a lot of different parts of this process, but I will say, you know, part of this is in a tax sale, you're buying a piece of the actual property. A tax lien auction process is you are buying the debt. Courts have said there could be a problem with the tax sale process. So this is sort of a hedge against us perhaps having constitutional problems with the system we have in place. So I want to stress, no courts have specifically ruled against Louisiana's process, but there's a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Minnesota, I believe, that lawyers here are worried could impact our process eventually. So the way supporters frame this is that this is a cleaner process that exists in many other states, this tax lien auction process. And then opponents make the argument that it could take longer to satisfy the debt, which means the local government will have more difficulty getting the property tax money to run its programs and services. The other thing this amendment does, not only does it change us to a tax lien auction process, but it would remove from the Constitution a whole bunch of the process that's in the Constitution and move it to statute. So in the future, if legislators want to tweak this process again, either to respond to complaints or court rulings or anything else, it would give them more latitude to do that long term. And then the other thing I'd say is none of this would take effect until 2026. So if this passes, they'd have a year to sort of work out some logistics and get local governments ready to move to the new system. And I'm sure that's clear as mud.
No, yeah, it's awesome. That no, you that okay? I understand it now. Basically, no. If we vote yes on this, we're getting ahead of a problem before it becomes a problem. If we vote yes, if we vote no, things are going to stay the same. Although there are cases in other states where we could be forced to change it in the future.
Pretty much. And the one thing I'll say is that opponents will make the argument that we have had a bunch of court rulings over the years and we've been able to respond to them as those court rulings have come up. And so why would we change our entire system if we haven't had a court ruling against us?
Understood. Okay. Well, if you visit parlouisiana.org, parlouisiana.org, you can get the full 16-page breakdown of the four amendments that are on this Saturday's ballot. In the meanwhile, fantastic information. Thank you so much for the time, Melinda. Melinda Dillette from PAR. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian.